Serving veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler. Brought to you by this local station and its sponsors. And presented everywhere on the air and online by Paul Everett's RV Country. With 8 locations in 5 western states.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and the World War II Navy story of Mike Wanty, an officer aboard the USS Lardner. We left off with that destroyer being sent on what seemed like a suicide mission to heavily defended Rabaul in Papua New Guinea.
We were the lead destroyer, and we torpedoed the nets and knocked apart a keeper, a small boat that was the keeper of the nets. And then the 5 of us went down to the end of the bay and then came back paralleling Rabaul, and well, opened up. We did mostly the docks. Some guys did the town. Some guys did the airfield. Whatever came up in the gun mounts. We shot our 40 millimeters and 20s, too. We were that close. And we left Rabaul burning. They thought it was an air strike, not any ships. No ships could get into the harbor. That was impossible, but we did.
And when you said that, you mentioned torpedoing the nets. So for people who don't understand, they had these nets strung across the harbor to keep ships out.
Yeah, destroyers and submarines. And they were mined to a certain degree.
Yeah. And you said right before that Admiral Halsey admitted later he really thought this was a suicide mission because of how well defended Rabaul was.
In here, too.
Yeah.
So then about 10 days later, he said, well, you guys were so lucky. I'm sending you to Okavian, to Rake Cavien. That was in the northern part, and you had to circle around the Admiralties and come in. But it was in the daytime, and they were waiting for us. And we didn't get off that time very easy. We lost, one of the destroyers lost men on the fantail where the guns were. We got shrapnel, and our lines that hold the flags were cut from a shell. You could even see the shell went. Anyway, we got out. We all came back, but we weren't banged up hardly at all, except for shrapnel.
Can I ask you a dumb question?
What?
When you're in a situation like that, Rabaul, where all these guns are going off and you're seeing it all happen, or the last one that you just mentioned, too, where your ship is damaged. Are you scared?
No.
You don't think, hey, this might be it for me?
No.
Why not?
I don't know. It's just another job.
Just
this
a job.
This is what I try and tell you. My daughter doesn't understand that word. It was just another job all the time. You know, 3 years aboard one ship, and you're doing all the day, all the time. It isn't just now and we'll wait for 6 months.
And before I forget, I know this is real tough for you to talk about, but when you told me that story about the Marine from Bougainville that came on your ship and how helpless it was wanting to help him and all you could do is give morphine and play White Christmas for him. But you said something there. You said your whole life you've wished you had gotten his name so you could have written his mother. What do you think you would have written to his mother? What would you have told her?
That he was brave and he thought of his family. He was a farm boy. I think from Ohio, I don't know. But I've always regretted that I didn't get his name and address. I could have, I think, but I didn't. I guess I was too busy. I don't know.
You had that job to do. And I don't want to assign something to it that's not there, but I just get the sense in hearing you talk about it that when you think about the war, the guys you served with, the courage it took, I almost get the sense that for you, that young man epitomized courage or set a standard that everyone else could try to achieve.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
So even after going through some of these battles, you don't start to feel like your job is dangerous and you might not be coming home?
Never entered my mind for some reason. It was just another job. And then the battle started with Guam and Tinian. We were off with the carriers. And during that time, you've heard of the Battle of the Philippine Seas?
Yes, sir.
Well, we had never seen so many carriers in our life. There was probably 20 carriers. We had only seen in the past Saratoga and the Langley and the Enterprise. That's all. In the early days when I first got there, we used to go up one side and the other, and we changed signals every night. and we could read what the Japanese were thinking. See, the code had been broken, and the Japanese thought there was three squadrons of carriers there. There weren't. There was only two old ones and five or six destroyers. That was when I first got there.
Uh-huh.
Had Japanese known that, they could have wiped us out overnight and gone all the way to San Francisco, but they didn't know it.
Mm-hmm.
They thought there was three squadrons, and they weren't about to tackle three squadrons.
Sure.
They had just finished with the Battle of the Coral Sea, and then the Battle of Savos had been cleared out. When I got there, we were clearing out everything ahead of us. Until we got to Rabaul, that was kind of a big deal, and then we joined Guam and Tinian. We were with the carriers then.
So you're protecting the carriers, picket duty.
Yeah. See, the carriers would take off, and they would bomb Guam, and then we got word there was a fleet of Japanese carriers coming down. We went to sea, and that's where the Battle of
Philippine Sea, yeah.
Yeah. I don't know how many planes took off. I think about 200 planes, and they wiped them out. Some guys got as many as five and six Japanese planes. A lot of them came back aces.
This is what became known as the Marianas Turkey Shoot, right?
The Turkey Shoot.
That was the nickname ascribed to it.
Yeah, right. And then that night, they gathered our squadron, and we were supposed to go on a torpedo attack against those ships. And we took off. In about 2 hours, they turned us around. The submarine said, we can finish them.
Mm.
Don't let the destroyers come. They may be beaten up. And so the submarines took care of them. So we turned around and joined them again. So then from there, we went to Iwo Jima. We bombed a little bit on the west side of Iwo Jima. And then from there, we came home for 18 days. Then we went back again to Lady Gulf. And then from there, we went to Okinawa. At Okinawa, we were out on the clock at 1 because the kamikazes were coming in. And they wanted to get the carriers. They didn't care about destroyers. And especially us, they would dodge us because we were an oak destroyer. They didn't care. So they got a few carriers. When we would get a contact, we would radio the carriers. And generally, we always had fighters above us.
Yeah.
And they would go after them. That lasted a while. And then we headed for Tokyo. And the fleet, the carriers went there. And I think for about 3 months, we went back and forth out to sea from Tokyo, and the planes bombarded Tokyo and all around there. And then the war was ended. We were given the honor to be the first ones in Tokyo Harbor.
Your ship?
Yeah, which I didn't think was the best honor. Our captain was smart enough. We went to general quarters, and we had those guns pointed, loaded. There was two Japanese destroyers on either side of us, and he was nervous. We didn't know what they were going to do. They had done kamikaze.
Yeah.
Why wouldn't they try and blow up that ship? So we never stopped for about 2 days. We went around and around in the harbor because we were afraid of these one-man submarines, you know?
Yeah, yeah. Was that before they signed the surrender in Tokyo Bay?
Yeah.
So you guys went in to kind of make sure that was safe.
That's right. Exactly.
So you were expendable.
Yes.
You were the ones they didn't care if you got blown up.
We always were.
You're a destroyer.
Right from the very beginning.
Yeah.
Always were.
I've got a few questions.
That's why we had the Lucky Shrimp and the Lardner, because we were lucky we never got hit. The Lucky Lardner.
The Lucky Lardner. You mentioned being at Iwo and shelling there a little bit. Now you know what happened at Iwo Jima and how many lives were lost.
Yeah.
But when you were going past and lobbing some shells at it, did you have any idea that that little hunk of land could be that big
no,
a battle?
No, none at all. It was just like another bombardment.
When did you first become aware of this threat of the kamikaze?
Lady Gulf. No, in the early part of the war, there weren't kamikazes.
Right.
The Zeros had good pilots.
Well, at Okinawa.
Well, we weren't around Okinawa. We were to the northern part to direct radar.
All right.
Where the planes were. They never bothered us. They would see us and go up, down, or right. Get away from us. They were afraid of us. They knew us. Tokyo Rose used to say when we were down in Guadalcanal, there goes the Lardner by.
Did you listen to her much?
Yeah. She had good music.
So when you were during Okinawa, you said you're up north and you're watching the planes. That was pretty important because you guys are passing on.
We were passing on where the planes were coming from.
So that gave those other ships a chance to shoot them down and not have the kamikaze set.
Yes.
And so you mentioned, so I want to understand the deal with Tokyo. So you guys get word that Japan is going to surrender?
Yeah, we were at sea and everybody cheered.
But they tell you, you're the first ones in.
We had to go pick up a few of the battle wagons, but we were the lead ship.
Uh-huh.
And we went on in. The battle wagons in the Missouri followed quite a few days after. We were at anchor then, and they anchored very close to us. So I could, with my binoculars, watch everything that was going on.
So you guys circle the harbor. You've got your guns out and all that. You make sure everything's fine. And then you drop anchor and wait for the bigger ships and the dignitaries.
Right.
And so you said you could watch through your binoculars. So were you looking that way when all the bigwigs got on there?
Oh, sure. And then after it was signed, then we had to go pick up prisoners of war. We went north and picked up some prisoners of war, brought them back. By that time, a hospital ship was anchored in Tokyo Bay, and we would deliver them.
Was that a shock to the system to see the kind of shape they were in?
Yeah. The ones we picked up are in fairly condition. They were electricians, and they had been down in Sumatra. But we didn't come home until after the war, until November.
Let Doris tell me her side, so I got to get the story of meeting Doris. So after the war, you got that geology degree from Oregon. You put it to use working in the oil business in Saudi Arabia.
Yeah, I was a geologist in Saudi Arabia. Then after 2.5 years, I came home. And on my trip home on a cheetah bus, I wanted to see Europe. And so we stopped off in Florence, Italy. A friend of my sister's was on the trip that Doris was on. I saw her get off the car, and I was on the bus. So I phoned her and took her out. And then the next night I took her out. And then the next night she came walking down the stairs with Doris. And I don't know why, but I knew that was the girl I wanted to marry. Don't ask me why. The fellows that I was with said, "You've been in the desert too long, Mike." Anyway, I went home. I wrote to her, and she came home early. And then I took her out a couple of times in Berkeley and came down to her house. I guess it all covered about 3 weeks, and I asked her to marry her, and she said yes. We got married within a month or less, and then she went back to Saudi Arabia with me. Then we had our first child and came home, and Clyde didn't want me to go back.
As your father-in-law?
And I said, "That's all right." So I stayed here and went in the cattle business.
Which was his business, and he said, "Hey, here's this land. Pick a spot, build a house."
That's right.
And now we're sitting on it,
yes,
on that spot. But you had no practice building a house, didn't know anything about it, and you did it yourself 65 years ago.
Yep.
You had the cattle business?
Just the cows.
Uh-huh.
For 40 years. And then I retired, and I put in 90 acres of almonds, and now I'm putting in 70 acres more right now.
And when I was talking to Doris about her time in the WASPs, she was downplaying it quite a bit.
She would. She always has. She doesn't think she did anything, but I don't think I did very much either. I've tried to tell you that. And Doris and I have always had good times. We've never had a fight.
67 years.
We've had an argument once in a while, but that's been over politics or something like that.
So if one of your grandkids comes to you and says, "What's the secret to a long-lasting marriage? 67 years worth of history you got here. What's your secret? What's your best piece of advice?"
Listen to her. Don't buck her. And if it's too much, give in to her. It's just another day. It blows over the next day. You know, I have a philosophy, always have had. The sun rises tomorrow.
Yes, it does. Right over there. Right over Yosemite National Park,
yeah,
huh?
Right.
You mentioned your ship's nickname, the Lucky Lardner. Were there some times where you felt that maybe you were being protected out there?
Yes, always have. The man up above, I've always thought that for my whole life. I've really had a good life. I've done a lot. I've always been successful. I'm in good health, fairly good.
I don't want to forget to say thank you. Thanks for serving our country. Thanks for telling us a little bit of your story.
Yeah, it's about a ship. It isn't about an individual or any individual. We all worked together. We had wonderful captains. All the guys were congenial.
Well, let me ask you this one last question. You got 96 years worth to think about here, but what would you say that you're most proud of, Mike?
And I'm honest. I've never screwed anybody, and I've always paid my bills, I think, honesty, and I believe in the Lord very much. I go through those pictures of my fraternity and my sister and father and mother and Brooks and Burr, which I grew up with, and my aunts and uncles and Clyde and Mildred every day. Thank them. And I thank God for another day on earth.
How's that for some perspective for you? That is Mike Wanty, 96 years young. And I want you to keep Mike in your prayers. As this program airs, he's in the hospital, but he's in great spirits. And he told me he just learned something new about his wife, Doris, and all that flying she did as a wasp in World War II. While she was visiting him in the hospital and they discussed snowy conditions in other parts of the country, she told him that taking off and landing in the snow was no problem. She did it many times. Mike says he never knew that before. So even after 67 years of marriage, there's still more to learn about each other. You can find photos of the Wantys at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. And join us again next time for the story of a Navy flyer who survived a crash landing in the Pacific that left him severely injured and then floated on a raft waiting to be picked up for more than 2 days. We're out of time for now. I'm Paul Effler, reminding you again that freedom is not free.